It would, I think, be wrong to say that it was the synagogue that was the main institution through which the Jewish faith was perpetuated. That would be the Jewish home, the Jewish family. It was the humble home of the Jews that provided the bulwark around the world against attempts to bring Judaism to an end, against attempts to force Jewish assimilation. But the synagogue ensured that the memory of the rhythms of the temple continued, and it oriented the Jewish people in its entirety toward Jerusalem. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 118, The Coin and the Kids. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. Several years ago, an interesting accidental discovery was made by Israeli children on a class trip. One report, featured in ArchaeoNewsNet.com, posted by the Israeli embassy, reports the following. Quote, 1,600 years after the edict of the Emperor Theodosius II led to the abolishment of the post of the Nasi, the head of the Sanhedrin, school pupils found a rare piece of evidence reflecting this dramatic moment in Jewish history. In February 2019, four ninth grade students from the Ha'emek HaMaravi High School in Kibbutz Yifat in the Jezreel Valley were orienteering in the fields along the Tzipori stream in the Galilee, adjacent to the Sanhedrin Trail, when they spotted a gold coin on the ground. The four pupils, Ido Kadosh, Ophir Sigal, Dotan Miller, and Harel Grin, realized immediately that this was a significant find, and they reported it to their geography and history teacher, Zohar Porshian, who contacted the Israel Antiquities Authority. The pupils handed the coin to Nir Distelfeld, the IAA anti-theft inspector, and showed him the spot in the field where the found had been made. Distelfeld awarded the boys certificates for their good citizenship, saying, "It is uncommon to find single gold coins as they were very valuable, and people took care not to lose them. I commend the pupils and their teacher for their good citizenship." End quote. The discovery is not only a fascinating find, but also an enormously symbolic one, reminding us of an emperor who delivered a real blow to the Jewish population in the Holy Land, but also of the fact that this emperor ultimately could not undo the Jewish people's connection to its most beloved city and to the Holy Land. In the year 408, the 7-year-old boy Theodosius II succeeded his father as full emperor of the eastern section of the empire. Several years later, his sister Pulcheria was made effectively his regent, given the title Augusta. Pulcheria was known for her loyalty to the state faith, as well as for her zeal for persecuting non-Christians. A very different approach, however, was taken by the woman originally known as Athenaeus, who was raised a pagan, was ultimately introduced to the young emperor, and became his wife. Athenaeus, who became known as Eudocia, was interested in a policy of toleration, and that, as we shall see in the next episode, ultimately led her to attempt to expand Jewish religious freedom in the Holy Land. That was not, however, the policy of her husband Theodosius, who issued one decree having severe repercussions for the future of Jewry in the land of Israel. This was an edict demoting the Nasi, the patriarch of the house of Hillel, Rabban Gamliel VI, apparently at least in part because Rabban Gamliel continued to build synagogues. Thus we have an edict issued by Theodosius together with his emperor in the West on the 25th of October in the year 415. Quote, "Since Gamliel supposed that he could transgress the law with impunity, all the more because he was elevated to the pinnacle of dignities, your illustrious authority shall know that our serenity has directed orders to the illustrious master of the offices that the appointment documents to the honorary prefecture shall be taken from him, so that he shall remain in the honor that was his before he was granted the prefecture, and henceforth he shall cause no synagogues to be founded. And, if there are any in deserted places, he shall see to it that they are destroyed, if it can be done without sedition." End quote. This demotion of Rabban Gamliel would have a real impact on the Jewish community in the land of Israel, for soon after, in 425, Rabban Gamliel died, and this marked the end of the position of Nasi, a position that had existed for many hundreds of years, and which had been held for much of that time by members of the Davidic Hillelian house. Thus, 425 marked the ending of a link between the Jews of the Holy Land and the Davidic dynasty, a connection to the origin of Jerusalem. In some historical accounts, including that of Simon Sebag Montefiore, Rabban Gamliel's death is ascribed to execution by Theodosius because Rabban Gamliel continued to build synagogues. What are we to make of the concern expressed by the emperors about Jews continuing to build houses of worship? Why would so severe a stand be taken against construction of these edifices? The answer perhaps lies in the fact that even some decades after Constantine, the religious state of the empire was still very much in flux. The wife of the emperor Theodosius grew up a pagan, and as we shall see tomorrow, she did seem to have some interest in, or at least profound sympathy for, Judaism. We have also mentioned how some Christians, to the consternation of the Roman authorities, still linked their observance of Easter to the date of the Passover observance of Jews. What this means is that the emperors were still worried about Christians becoming attracted to Judaism. The historian Marcel Simon very interestingly links this edict of Theodosius with others by that emperor as well as by his predecessors, edicts proclaiming that Christian converts to Judaism were to be severely punished. Thus Simon tells us, quote, "The laws suppressing proselytism form a series stretching from the peace of the church under Constantine to the redaction of the Theodosian Code. The very fact that they are repeated and the severity of the penalties laid down are proof both of their ineffectiveness and of the seriousness of the danger. Some of the enactments strike directly and explicitly at proselytism. Others achieve the same end obliquely, being aimed at suppressing particular forms of proselytism or removing particular opportunities for it. From AD 315 onwards, Constantine prosecuted the new policy energetically, forbidding conversions to Judaism on pain of death. The prohibition was several times renewed by his successors. Constantius provided for the confiscation of the goods of apostates. Gratian forbade them to leave their property in a will." End quote. What this means is that in an age when emperors were worried about conversion to Judaism, synagogues also became a target of their edicts. We must understand that synagogues were open to all, both Jews and non-Jews could enter. And in an age of diverse religious interests, one can imagine non-Jews entering synagogues in order to learn about the tenets of the Jewish faith. Thus, one Christian leader in Constantinople, John Chrysostom, delivered a lengthy homily pleading with Christians not to enter synagogues, describing those who came to visit the Jews on Rosh Hashanah, apparently out of interest. Chrysostom said, quote, "And let me say, if a man sees you that have knowledge come into the synagogue and participate in the festival of the trumpets, shall not his conscience being weak be emboldened to admire what the Jews do? He who falls not only pays the penalty for his own fall, but he is also punished because he trips others as well. But the man who has stood firm is rewarded not only because of his own virtue, but people admire him for leading others to desire the same things. Therefore, flee the gatherings and holy places of the Jews. Let no man venerate the synagogue because of the holy books." End quote. The language Chrysostom uses highlights the lure that some may have felt coming from the synagogue. To come to a Jewish place of worship would have meant coming in contact with the text of the scripture in the original Hebrew, to see the rituals and lifestyle of the Tanakh still being lived. Marcel Simon sees the Edict of Theodosius as reflecting a concern that the growth of synagogues might lead to an increase of interest in embracing Judaism itself. Simon writes, quote, "In the ancient world, the proselytizing efforts of Israel were always organized around the synagogue, which was open to all goyim who were in search of truth. Chrysostom's appeals to the faithful, adjuring them not to go near these places of perdition, illuminates this aspect of the code. In order to counteract proselytism, it was not enough to forbid Jews to practice it in open and aggressive form. It was also necessary to reduce the permanent possibilities for proselytism that the public worship of the synagogue provided." End quote. This is very interesting, yet it should be added that for Jews, the purpose of creating synagogues was not for the purpose of proselytizing, but rather to allow a Jerusalem-linked Judaism to endure. As we have seen, the rules of the Jewish liturgical experience were designed not merely to create a form of Jewish public ritual expression, but also to keep the memory of Jerusalem and the temple alive. Every one of the prayer services was oriented toward the time of the daily communal offering that would have been brought that day had the temple still stood. The prayers themselves were recited facing Jerusalem, and they included a plea for God's return to the sacred city, for the flourishing of the Davidic dynasty, and for the restoration of the temple. It would, I think, be wrong to say that it was the synagogue that was the main institution through which the Jewish faith was perpetuated. That would be the Jewish home, the Jewish family. It was the humble home of the Jews that provided the bulwark around the world against attempts to bring Judaism to an end, against attempts to force Jewish assimilation. But the synagogue ensured that the memory of the rhythms of the temple continued, and it oriented the Jewish people in its entirety toward Jerusalem. We can understand why the ending of the position of Nasi is understood to be a real blow to Jewish life in the land of Israel. The Talmud recounts how standing before Vespasian, Yochanan ben Zakkai had pleaded for the preservation of the leadership of the Hillelian family. This was meant to unite the Jews of the Holy Land and to keep that connection in the Holy Land to the Davidic dynasty. This source of unity and recollection of Davidic Jerusalem was suddenly lost in 425 CE. But nothing would sever the Jewish connection to Jerusalem no matter how far the Jewish diaspora spread around the world, and we can therefore appreciate the irony of this coin of Theodosius, adorned with images proclaiming his power, suddenly being discovered by a group of Jewish kids in a flourishing Jewish state. And we can appreciate profoundly precisely where the coin was found. In the article, Yair Amitzur of the Israel Antiquities Authority tells us why. Quote, "Emperor Theodosius II, who appears on the coin, is the one that ordered the cancellation of the presidency of the Sanhedrin, network of rabbinical judges, the leadership of the Jewish people at that time, and the transfer of Jewish donations to the imperial treasury instead of the Sanhedrin. Following the abolition of the presidency by Theodosius, the Sanhedrin ceased to exist, and the leadership of the Jewish people moved to Babylon and then to the diaspora for 2,000 years. It is symbolic that the coin with Emperor Theodosius II impressed on it was found by Israeli students near the Sanhedrin Trail, a hiking route prepared this year by Israel Antiquities Authority that follows the leadership of the Jewish people in the Galilee during the period of the Mishnah and the Talmud." End quote. To study this coin is to recall a truly trying time for the Jews in the Holy Land. But the coin's discovery is also a reminder of the wondrous times in which we live today. This is Meir Soloveitchik. Looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.